Welcome to episode 7 of season 18 of the Growing Empire Show. Today I'm here with my special guest, Robert Beardsley from Lone Star Capital. And today we're going to talk about Rob's journey into real estate investing and the successes that he's had over the years. From his college time to over $600 million in multifamily deals, Rob's had quite the journey with a lot of lessons along the way. He was inspired to write The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions and has been investing in the real estate community for many years now. Rob is going to talk to us about his asset acquisitions and why they're focusing on the Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio markets, as well as what prompted him to develop his own underwriting software models. I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with Rob, so make sure you stay tuned.
Welcome to Growing Empires, hosted by real estate entrepreneur and trusted investment advisor, Jennifer DeJesus. Growing Empires provides insight to building wealth through passive income-producing real estate investments for those who want to build and manage a more profitable real estate portfolio.
Welcome, Rob, to the Growing Empire Show. I'm so glad that you're here. Let's kick off this episode with you sharing a little bit about your background and the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So I'm the founder of Lone Star Capital. We're here based in New York City, but we focus exclusively on Texas workforce housing. So we've acquired over $600 million in multifamily properties since 2018. Growing up, I actually grew up in a real estate family back in California. My parents ran a residential brokerage firm from home. So I was exposed to real estate at a young age, but I saw them struggling kind of on the brokerage side, and they never were investing in real estate. Actually, they were just on the transaction side. So that didn't really resonate with me. And it wasn't until I did all the cliche things like read Rich Dad, Poor Dad and scroll through Bigger Pockets and really go down that rabbit hole that I got the real estate bug officially. And that was actually in college. So I went to school for computer science thinking I would, you know, stay in Silicon Valley and do something, you know, computer science related. And, you know, like I said, I got the real estate bug. My business partner and I met while we were in school. He was much older, more experienced. He was a tax attorney, and he was looking for an entrepreneurial new venture. And I was just super excited about real estate. So we started Lone Star Capital together. I dropped out of school. He left his corporate job. And, you know, we were off to the races from there.
Awesome. Well, today we're going to talk about investing in multifamilies. We'll specifically talk a little bit more about underwriting, the locations that you're in currently, why you're targeting those specific areas. And I've asked Rob to join me to share his wealth of knowledge that he's gained throughout the years on these subjects. So let's just kind of jump right in. So you shared a little bit about your journey, but what led you to actually target multifamily specifically?
Yeah, I think it's similar to what attracts a lot of people to multifamily, which is it's so relatable. You know, all of us have a roof, I'd hope, have a roof over our heads and a place to live. And, you know, probably at one point or another lived in a multifamily property or still do to this day. So I think it's a very relatable asset class. It's also, as people can understand, it's an asset class by necessity. People need a place to live. For me specifically, it was very straightforward to make the transition from single family to multifamily because I really had a decent amount of experience and background from my family's former brokerage business on the residential side that, you know, going from one unit to 100 units is actually quite straightforward.
Okay. You also wrote a book, right? The Definitive Guide to Underwriting Multifamily Acquisitions. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So tell me about that book and what made you write it? How long ago did you write it? And what was kind of your target audience at that point?
Yeah, so that book I published in May of 2020, and I started writing it just maybe a month or so before those famous lockdowns took place. And when things kind of slowed down for COVID, I figured, okay, this is a great time to just buckle down and finish writing the book. So I raced to finish it and then self-published it, self-edited it, and released it. And the reason why I was so excited about this book is because it was exactly what I was looking for when I first started in the business, but it didn't exist. So I really felt like I was filling a void that a lot of people just like myself would be looking for. And it turned out to be quite true because the book did really well, you know, without any sort of formal promotion or marketing push or anything like that. It just, it's a very niche topic. So obviously it's not like a New York Times bestseller, but for the people that care and for the people that are looking for it, it's like, ah, that's exactly what I need. And so it actually sold really well. I think at this point we've sold probably nearly 20,000 copies, and we have built so many relationships from people buying and reading the book, and built a lot of trust too. It's kind of like a fast track to building trust, because one thing I didn't really anticipate from the book, because it's so niche, because it's kind of in the weeds and advanced, I didn't really think passive investors would read it. But it turned out to not be true, and that actually a lot of passive investors are savvy and they were interested in that topic. And so we would actually attract investors from the book as well.
Oh, very cool. So tell me a little bit more about the context of the book. So is it specific to only underwriting multifamily deals? Is that the whole context of the entire book?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's super niche. So basically what the way I wrote the book was really straightforward. I looked at the underwriting model that I had built when we first started the business, and that we continue to this day use every single day to analyze about 500 investments per year. And the way I wrote the book is I basically just looked at our underwriting process. I looked at the underwriting model that we use, and I just went through every single formula, every single input, and I just wrote about it and just kind of built the process from start to finish. This is how we look at deals. This is how we analyze every element. So it was a really straightforward book for me to write, because the table of contents was basically right there in front of me. It was just, hey, talk about every input, talk about the process. So yeah, it was very niche in that regard.
Tell me a little bit more about this proprietary software that you created.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, there's people out there online that, I mean, mostly everyone builds a model for their own analysis. But it's funny because some people sell their own model for $200 or $1,000. And then I saw recently on LinkedIn, someone was selling it for $3,000. It's like, well, at the end of the day, real estate's a pretty simple business. And when you're underwriting multifamily, you're just basically doing addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. It's not rocket science. And to me, it's a kind of an odd thing to keep it private and to sell it for money, because it's like, it's really not that special. And so this model that I built from very early on back in 2018, and have just edited it and refined it over time, we've always made it available on our website for free. And we continually make edits to it, and we continue to push those edits out to the public. And, you know, there's probably, I don't know, there's decent handful. There's probably a few dozen groups that are multifamily owners and investors like us that use our spreadsheet every single day to analyze their potential investments. So it's, you know, to me, it was like a strategic decision just to give it away for free and just to build a community and kind of build that goodwill rather than try to make a couple bucks selling it. Or the thing that really kind of weirds me out is when people ask for someone's model and they say, no, it's proprietary. I can't share it. It's confidential. Because if an investor comes to us and says, hey, I want to actually look under the hood and look at your analysis, of course we have to share that, right? We can't, to me, it's just crazy to keep that confidential.
Yeah. Why would somebody invest if they don't even know what they're investing in or what the numbers look like? So you have been in the business for quite some time now, and I'm sure after acquiring $600 million in multifamily real estate, you have some key lessons that you've learned, things that maybe were huge successes and then some things that maybe were not so successful that you won't do again. Walk me through a couple of these, you know, key takeaways from your years so far in business.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of lessons. And I think the important thing is, you know, obviously you want to avoid mistakes, but you definitely want to make sure that you learn from every single mistake and hopefully learn from others' mistakes. So some mistakes that we made early on were, you know, looking back, really basic and unfortunate. But I would say from a deal standpoint, one mistake that we made on our very first acquisition was not understanding that if you're going to do a value add business plan, which is really a lot of people's favorite type of deal. A value add plan is when you renovate the property to increase rents, to increase value. You're looking for ways to actually add value, right? So it's a value add plan. The thing about value add plans is you need to understand how it's going to affect the community, and you need to understand the timeline it's going to take to actually make that business plan happen, right? I think a lot of people make the mistake of kind of overlooking this idea that, well, if you do plan to raise rents through renovations, that could work out, but what's the timeline? And I think people underestimate how long it takes to actually take over, settle things, and then raise rents over time, because obviously you can't renovate and, you know, you can't kick everyone out overnight and just renovate all the units and then raise everyone's rent immediately. And even if you could do that, you may not want to do that, because you may want to kind of slowly, methodically go through your business plan, test the waters. Because if you just do 200 unit renovations at once, you might find out that your guess that the residents would be willing to pay more for granite countertops, you might guess that that's a wrong guess. And if you're wrong on that, it's better to be wrong on 10 units or 20 units than 200, because you might come to find out that actually what residents really wanted was for you to put in washers and dryers into the units. So I think understanding that timeline takes a while, and it should, is definitely a mistake that we made and I see a lot of people make, because it's like in the spreadsheet, you can just make the rents go from this to this in an instant. But Sure. Obviously in reality, it takes some time. The other piece early on a different part of the business, on the investor relations part of the business, is this is a really fundamental one, and it's a real big challenge. And we made the mistake of believing that if we find a good deal, the money will come. And we kind of just soaked up that, we drank that Kool-Aid. But the reality is that's just completely untrue. Good deals and bad deals are getting oversubscribed every single day. Right. So it really doesn't matter how good the deal is. It does come down to the relationships, to the marketing, to the sales. And for us, thinking that we were starting a real estate business, we kind of thought of sales and marketing as an afterthought. We thought, oh, like that's just an annoying thing that we have to do. Like we have to talk to investors. But the actual real deal truth about this business is that sales and marketing and investor relations is fully 50%. Of the job. So if you are in this business and looking to actually do deals and be a deal maker and raise money and work with investors, you have to understand that 50% of the job is thought leadership, marketing, sales, talking to investors, dealing with investor questions on new deals, on existing deals. It is, I mean, there's a reason why people have full departments for marketing, sales, and everything.
So talk to me a little bit about your partnership. You referenced one other partner that sounds like more of the tax guy, right? At least from what you referenced. But how do you operate your partnership? Who does what? And are you bringing in other people to every deal based on the deal? Or is there another team behind you? Give me the kind of the layout of that.
Yeah, would love to. So we have at this point, I'm proud to say we have a strong and growing team, but obviously it wasn't always that way. Starting out, my business partner, Kent, and I, we just wore all the hats necessary to get a deal done. And that would mean that it was sometimes all hands on deck and both of us were talking to lenders at the same time, or it was dividing and conquering. For a very long time, my business partner was responsible for overseeing operations and I was overseeing asset management. But if you go even further back, there were no operations because we didn't own anything yet. So all we were doing was we were in acquisitions mode. So it's just funny that as you start and as you grow, kind of the responsibilities and the weighting of each responsibility changes over time. And where we find ourselves today, I am now kind of the quasi CEO. And so I manage the people and I manage the operations, and my business partner is more so on the strategy side and the tax side, like you said. We actually do a lot of fancy things on the tax side in terms of property tax exemptions. We have many nonprofit and affordable housing partnerships that we do across our portfolio. So we do a lot of fancy things it takes a lot of time and effort. So my business partners focus on that. He also focuses on debt and acquisition. So he kind of uses his expertise where it needs to be. And then on my end, I oversee our director of acquisitions, our director of investor relations. I oversee our asset management team, which oversees our portfolio. So that's kind of how we have it today, but I'm sure it'll change as we continue to grow. So I think we have about 15, 16 employees in total.
Oh, wow. Congrats. So what was your very first deal? Very, very first thing that Lone Star Capital purchased. What was it?
Yeah, the very first deal we bought was a 261 unit property in Houston. It was a 1980s vintage, like your typical crime, bad tenant base, workforce housing. And we had no idea what we were getting into. Like, we had no idea what we were getting into from the size of the deal. 261 units, that's a big deal. It was, you know, we had to raise $4.5 million. We had no idea how hard that would be. And then we had no idea what we were buying from a business plan standpoint, because we kind of just didn't have the experience. We didn't know what it meant to buy a property that had high crime, non-paying tenants, and deferred maintenance, right? So we really threw ourselves into the fire.
And what did you learn from that specific experience? Because you're right, tiptoeing on 200 plus doors is not tiptoe. That's yeah. Jumping in with your clothes on. So, what did you learn about that? Well, first of all, do you still have that property in your portfolio, or did you sell it?
Yeah, we sold it in December of 21.
Okay. Was it a profitable investment, even though you were learning, or was it a not so profitable investment?
It was. We could have done better, for sure, but we ended up returning 17% IRR to our investors.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Good job. Congrats. So what were some of the key takeaways from that big first deal?
Yeah. So going back to the stories I was telling, I'm just thinking exactly about that deal. I'm thinking about how we looked at each other and we're like, oh, raise $4.5 million? That should be doable.
Yeah.
But in reality, that is really, really hard to do. I think raising money is one of the hardest things to do in the world. And coupled with the fact that I think people overestimate their ability to raise money, because you know, you talk to some people and they go, yeah, I'd be interested. But when push comes to shove, when it's actually time for someone to take money from their account and put it into your account, that's a really tough thing to do. So especially on your first deal, it's probably the hardest thing we ever did. And it didn't get easier with the second one or much easier with the third one. It really does take a long time to build those relationships and that trust and that track record. So that was a big lesson that we learned and mistake. And so the takeaway is we should have been building those investor relationships way before the deal, right? I always say you have to dig the well before you're thirsty, because if you're under contract and you're looking to raise money, it's already too late, right? You should be priming the pump and putting out the content strategy and the thought leadership and having those meetings before the deal. So that was a big mistake that we made. And now, you know, we certainly don't have an issue with that at all. We invest heavily into the content that we produce and doing podcasts like this and writing books and articles and just staying in front of our investors and in the most positive way possible. So that's a really big one. Yeah, I would say that's the biggest thing we learned from that deal. And then kind of similar, like the business plan stuff, the challenges, like we bought the deal at, I want to say like 85% occupancy. And obviously our business plan was to go to 95. But the thing that not everyone realizes is that the path from 85 to 95 isn't always just 10% up, because we actually went down to 70,
of course,
and then went to 95. And obviously we didn't anticipate that or budget that. So when we had to cut distributions down to investors on that first deal, they obviously weren't happy because we didn't manage expectations properly. What we should have told investors is, hey, don't anticipate any distributions for the first 6 months or the first year, right? And then we get back to business. So I think there's just so many lessons from every deal, every day, but those are the big ones.
I completely understand what you're saying. I actually tell investors all the time, think of multifamily as a J curve. You must go down before you go up, right? It's the way it has to happen, right? If you're going to really put value add into it. Now, of course, if you're buying A class, that's a different story, right? But in most markets where you're seeing the biggest bang for your buck, you know, multifamily and the value add is a great place to be, but it does take some work, and you do have to factor in the, you know, the unknowns, and you have to factor in the time that it takes to, you know, release and turn over units and spend money and, you know, capital and, you know, all those things. So I completely get it. So you talked about Lone Star Capital being focused in, I think you mentioned Dallas, Houston, Texas markets. So why Texas? What are you finding down there that made you say, I mean, as being New York guys, why are we down in Texas?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't have necessarily a great answer, because the reality is there's a lot of great markets around the country. I'm not going around preaching that, hey, the only place to invest is in Texas. You know, I think you can do well pretty much everywhere. For us, however, the reason why we chose Texas and really stuck there ever since, you know, the initial choice to be there was because we had some existing relationships there, and we had a mentor who owned a lot of property down there. So it was kind of a simple, straightforward place to start. But the reason for staying is because of the continued growth and just the really favorable demographics that continue to be true in Texas. Dallas and Houston are usually at the top of the country list as far as number one population growth, number one job growth. So these are big markets with big trends, because it's one thing for a little market to have a big trend. That could be great, but it's hard to get scale there. So the beautiful thing about the major markets of Texas is they're big, and you can look at a lot of deals, you can pass on a lot, and you can still buy a lot. So, you know, we don't want to be the most aggressive or the most active buyers in the world, but, you know, our acquisition targets are based, you know, somewhere around 200 to 300 million in acquisitions per year. So as we work towards reaching that goal, we have to make sure that we're playing in a sandbox big enough for that goal. And the other thing for us is focus. Focus is a really big philosophy of ours. And so I don't want to have to be in many different states in order to hit our business goals. And the beautiful thing of the scale in Texas is we could be in just Houston, for example. Like, we have, I think, about almost half a billion just in Houston. So the majority of our assets are in Houston, and that focus lets us have great rapport and relationships with the brokers, since we've done so much business with them and in those areas. We also know the markets really well, and we also have local teams there. And it's really easy to go from property to property, which is, you know, obviously you can't take that for granted. Like, it really is convenient and nice to just be able to. We have three sets of properties in our portfolio that are adjacent to each other. So literally just right next to each other. And so we can do more creative payroll things, manage them more easily. So there's a ton of benefits to focus. The advice I would tell people, if you're an operator, is you will have more success focusing on one market rather than multiple, which is counterintuitive, because when I started in the business, I was thinking, well, if the more markets I look at, the more chance I have to be successful. But it's actually the opposite. If you just look at one market, you will be more successful. Now, if you're a passive investor, I would recommend being diversified and investing across different markets, different strategies, and different sponsors.
The episode will continue in just a moment.
As an investor, we know it's important to stay on top of market trends and real estate opportunities that add value to your portfolio. We also know that having a trusted source of reliable information to help you stay a step ahead of other investors is critical to your success. If you're interested in having these types of resources, as well as access to me and my team, I invite you to join the Empire Investment Club, a free service that gives you an easier way to make sense of today's and tomorrow's real estate opportunities. As a member of the Empire Investment Club, you'll get access to relevant resources and investment-focused experiences such as live interactive webinars, market trend presentations, and investor socials designed to equip you with what you need to succeed. So whether you're an active investor, passive investor, a combination of both, or just starting out, the club is where you'll get what you need to build a portfolio you love. To join, just head over to jenniferdejesus.com, sign up, and we'll see you in the club, where everyone's on a journey to becoming a better investor. So is Lone Star Capital strictly syndicating deal by deal, or are you doing hedge funds or anything like that under that umbrella, or is it strictly just syndications?
So we do raise money only on a deal by deal basis. We don't invest out of any funds or anything like that, but the way that we put those deals together can vary. So some deals look like a true pure syndication where the capital's coming in from individual investors investing $50,000 to $500,000. But we also have deals that are joint ventures. So we have multiple joint ventures in the portfolio where a large partner, like a family office or a private equity firm, puts up the majority of the investment capital. And then we bring in a minority piece from ourselves and from some of our smaller, personal investors. And that operates like a JV where they have major decision rights, they have control rights. So we do it. We do it both ways.
Okay. And what are you targeting currently today? Are you still targeting multifamily? Are you still targeting value add? And what typically is the size of the deal that you're targeting today?
Today, we're seeking deals that are $30 to $60 million. And we are still in Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio. So we're in the major markets of Texas, not quite Austin yet, just because we haven't decided to expand our focus yet, but I'm sure we will. And as far as strategy, I would say that we've done less value add in the last few years because of we don't feel like value add in our markets has been quite as attractively priced as other opportunities. As the market has changed and rates have gone up and prices have shifted across different asset classes, we've found that buying like B plus and A properties in certain cases at a good cap rate can be a better business plan than taking the risk on an older asset. So it's different, but we definitely still have an appetite for value add. You know, we have a 1970s vintage deal under contract in Dallas right now. And that's like your traditional straight value add. We're going to go in there, redo everything. It's going to be a transformation. So I'm super excited about that because we actually haven't done one of those deals in years. On the other hand, we have another deal under contract right now in Houston, which is a Class A deal. It's beautiful inside and out. And the business plan from a renovation standpoint is very minimal. We're focusing on preserving affordability on that deal by doing a housing authority partnership to place income and rent restrictions on the property.
Okay. Historically, what kind of returns are you giving back to your investors? And how long do you typically hold their capital?
Yeah, we're looking to return capital in about 3 years is, I would say, the goal. That's been the average for the two exits. We have another sale coming up in August. That will be almost exactly a three-year hold as well. So we're kind of right in that three-year hold range as the target. And we are targeting to return about a 15% to 17% IRR back to investors net of fees. And so between the two exits that we've had so far, we have averaged, I think, about 24%. So obviously the name of the game is under-promising and over-delivering.
Sure.
And, that's what we're fighting for every day.
Well, congrats to you. Those are incredible returns and they're not easy. So congrats on that. You guys are obviously doing a great job at protecting investors' money. So you mentioned tax advantage strategies, and you mentioned that there's a boatload of them that you're using. On obviously, every deal would be a little different, and I get that. But let's dive into some of those, because I think that, real estate is obviously a really cool thing to invest your money in, and it definitely will historically turn a great return on investment. But the additional ability to take your money and use it in tax-deferred opportunities or, tax privileged opportunities, I think is almost an entirely more incredible benefit of real estate, right? So let's talk about some of the tax strategies that Lone Star Capital is currently using, what you've done over the years, even if you're not currently doing it, some of the strategies that you're using, and how is that impacting the returns to the investors?
Yeah, there's so many ways to utilize tax advantages in real estate. I think when you analyze real estate as an investment versus other options on a post-tax basis, it's really, really difficult to make an argument for anything but for an individual to invest in real estate.
I agree.
Now, obviously, when it comes to Harvard's endowment or another tax-exempt investing entity, then it's like, okay, they can actually take a good look at the stock market versus real estate. But if you are a U.S. tax-paying individual, it just does not make any sense whatsoever. Like it should not even be an argument. And that's obviously sounds bias coming from me, but it just really is the truth. So with that being said, the very simple tax advantages that real estate investors can utilize, first and foremost, are depreciation and 1031 exchanges. So through depreciation, which is a non-cash write-off, non-cash expense, basically allowing you to reduce your taxable income for the investment. And also you can utilize it to offset other gains in your portfolio. If you're a real estate professional from a tax perspective, then you can use it to offset all forms of income. So this is a great income shielder that you can use. So depreciation is super important for our business. And the other one is 1031 exchanges, because unfortunately depreciation eventually has to be recaptured. So it's actually a deferral, not a permanent shielder. So what you do is you defer your tax liability with depreciation, and then you kick the can even further down the road with 1031 exchanges, which allow you to sell a property and then take the gain of that property from that investment. And instead of paying the tax on that gain, you can defer the gain, roll over that those dollars into a new deal, and then you successfully defer the capital gains taxes associated with the sale. So this allows you to more efficiently, more quickly compound your wealth over time without the tax drag associated from every deal. You buy it, you make some money, pay tax, buy, make some money, pay tax. This is really the superior way to go. So we do a lot of 1031 exchanging in our business because we not only facilitate the 1031 exchanges for our investors into our deals. So for example, if let's say a commercial real estate investor wants to sell one of the buildings in their portfolio and then 1031 exchange into more of a hands-off investment by working with us, we can facilitate them 1031 exchanging directly into one of our projects. Similar to that, we also do deal level exchanges. So when we're getting ready to sell this property that's coming up in August, when we close on that sale, we'll be 1031 exchanging the funds, the investor funds from that deal into another deal that we have under contract. So it's just staying in the game, never paying the tax, and just pushing the ball forward. So I would say those are the big highlights that everyone who pays, who's a U.S. taxpaying individual, should 100% be looking at.
Are you also utilizing cost segregation studies for your assets in your portfolio?
Yes. Yeah. Every single deal we do cost seg. And while it's been around, we've been electing for bonus depreciation as well.
Okay. What do you think of the upcoming election? Do you think it's going to have an impact on your strategies as far as you could tell as of this moment?
Yeah. Well, that bill that was bringing back 100% bonus depreciation, which would be a big, big deal for commercial real estate. It's been stuck in the Senate for months, and I don't think people really have confidence in it anymore. So who knows if that would really ever come to light. But I would imagine that if a Republican gets elected, then it would have a greater chance of being brought back to 100% bonus depreciation, because Trump made that happen in 2017 for the Tax Cuts, Jobs and Tax Cuts Act or something like that. So I'd imagine he would want to bring it back and kind of get everyone riled up and excited. I would imagine, honestly, that Democrats would want to do that too, because I think that the economy is going to be in need of some real stimulation coming up here, as things have slowed down seemingly after all of this government spending has slowed down coming out of COVID.
Yeah. I agree. So going back to these tax strategies, so how do your investors actually take advantage of these tax strategies that you're utilizing while they're in your syndication?
Yeah. So what an investor in our syndications can expect is an annual K-1 that they receive, hopefully by March 15th, but it sometimes gets delayed to the end of March. So that's kind of the nature of the beast with private placements and private investments. But a K-1 is basically a schedule, is a partner's schedule in an LLC. And so that shows their share of income and of losses. And so the losses is the really important piece on the K-1 every year that they can then utilize to offset their taxable income. And if they have, for example, a different real estate project that is generating taxable income, but the investment that they invested with us, let's say in the first year, is generating a big depreciation paper loss, not a real loss, but a tax loss for tax purposes. They can take that loss and then offset the income in their other real estate deal, or if they have gains in their stock portfolio, so they can utilize it to offset their portfolio income. On the 1031 exchange side, investors who invest in our syndications can sit back and do nothing. There isn't any work on their end to essentially consent and ride along with an exchange. It's not mandatory, so they can opt out and just take the cash. That's no problem. But if they elect to roll forward, we handle all of the work associated with the closing and the qualified intermediary and the identification process and making sure that that partnership successfully handles the exchange into the next deal. So yeah, it's pretty straightforward for investors, but you know, obviously they want to consult their CPA and work on the K-1s every year.
Understood. So you had mentioned that you're targeting in the Dallas and Houston and San Antonio market. You mentioned that you are targeting workforce housing. And I think you also mentioned something else. I don't remember the name that you gave it, but I think you said workforce housing is kind of what you're targeting. Why that specific segment of multifamily?
I think the best risk-adjusted returns are in the workforce space. And workforce is a really broad term. I mean,
sure,
you can lump in like C-class and maybe even D-class properties into workforce housing. And then you could also lump in like quite nice deals into workforce. So I'd say workforce is a very broad category. I would say as time has gone on, we have leaned into wanting to buy newer, nicer properties and properties that are in areas of higher income. So it could still be considered workforce, but you know, these days, a pocket or a neighborhood where people make, you know, $70,000 to $90,000 per year, it's still very much so workforce housing. So I would say that that's kind of what we're truly looking for. It's that renter by necessity demographic. You know, when you get into luxury rentals, it's a very different space. It's not something that we have experience with. I'm sure if we got in that space, we would find our way and do well, but the cap rates are very low there. So the return expectations are very low. And, you know, for a younger, newer firm like ours, the return expectations from investors is higher, right? If an investor wants to go and get a nice, boring, and slow and steady return in safe investments, then they would invest with Blackstone, or they invest in the stock market, or someone that's been around for a long time. But a smaller company like ours, you know, they are seeking 15, 16, 17% returns. And so in order for us to be able to do that, we need to actually roll up our sleeves and, you know, get on site and make things happen and dodge some bullets along the way and, you know, really make some value happen.
And you also created your own property management arm. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Okay. So your vertically integrated company is overseeing the asset management of all of the deals that you have currently, correct?
Yeah. And we recently renamed the property management company to Lone Star Communities. So we're kind of trying to bring our companies together as one and just be one unit working together to create maximum value for tenants and investors alike. And so we're in the process of rebuilding the organization and the culture right now so that the on-site teams that are handling the property and the residents every single day, that we work closely with them and that we are really giving them the keys to be successful.
What made you do that? What made you, you know, create your own organization, your vertically integrated company in retrospect to just using somebody that was already in the marketplace doing property management?
Yeah, there's a lot of benefits associated with it, but it really comes down to what you make of it. And it's kind of like you just have more control. You have more control over your destiny. And it's because there's plenty of third-party management companies that can do a great job for you, and there's plenty that could screw it up for you. But the same is true for managing the properties yourself. You could screw it up yourself, or you could make it great. So it really, at the end of the day, it's not a sure thing that it's going to be better if you bring operations in-house, but at least it gives you the control to make the changes that you want. You can be more nimble. You can be more flexible. And there's more transparency. And something that we kind of maintain this. I mean, we are a small company and we want to maintain that small company culture of nimbleness and not have all these layers of bureaucracy and have to get these different approvals and everything takes so much time. So yeah, there's a lot of benefits with just being able to effectuate change very quickly and be more flexible.
Do you think having that integration has dramatically impacted your returns for your investors?
I would say that we are still, I would say in some cases, yes. I would say in other cases, we're still learning. And, you know, there's things that we made a mistake on where we probably would have just been better off having a third party just handle it. But in the long run, I'm very, very confident that we will have outsized returns that we can attribute to having property management in-house. And that's a really, really big deal.
Okay. So what didn't I ask you that you wish I would have?
That's a great question.
It's usually one that I stump everybody on.
Yeah, that's very good. There's so many topics. I mean, I'll just tell you right now, I'm really passionate about the operational side of the business. That's my main focus. I am in the New York office right now, but I'm here just for the week. And I actually am living in Houston right now. I took an apartment at our latest acquisition. And so I'm living on site and I'm just working with the on-site teams and I'm really like undercover boss, but I'm very much not undercover. I'm making my presence known. I'm hiring, I'm firing, I'm setting new standards. So I'm really passionate about rebuilding our culture and firing people up and trying to get everyone, you know, to set the bar higher.
That's awesome. So how can my listeners get in contact with you if they'd like to know more about Lone Star Capital?
To learn more about us at Lone Star Capital, investors or listeners can head to our website, lscre.com. Like I mentioned earlier on our website, you can download our underwriting model for free that we update. We've got some other free resources and also links to the books that we've published and ways to get in touch.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Rob, for your time today. It was certainly a pleasure speaking with you and congrats on all your success with Lone Star Capital. Wish you nothing but the best in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode with my special guest, Rob Beardsley of Lone Star Capital. I hope you enjoyed our episode. And until next time, take care.
For more information about how Jennifer can help you plan, develop, and manage a strong real estate investment portfolio, visit growingempires.com.